Today's our third session in moral issues in medicine, and for those of you who just come into the village, I'm John Collins. I'm a family physician from Spokane, Washington. Our first session, we talked about the money matter in medicine, and we're probably going to get back into a little bit of that today from a different angle. Our second session, we talked about abortion, and we're going to get back into that, I think, today probably also. Our main topic today is the topic of genetics. Most of you probably think that is not really of much interest to you unless you happen to be going to go into biology or one of the sciences that genetics might have some importance to. But really, I think you'll realize or come to realize that genetics is going to be very important in your life. And we're looking at a problem which is going to become more and more of a moral issue in our society as the years go by. How many people in this room have direct relatives who have some type of a congenital deformity or disease? Would you raise your hand? Okay, we have 3, 4 here. Those of you who hold your hand, now leave them up. Now, how many other people in here have relatives, direct relatives, who also have diseases like cancer, diabetes, arthritis, hypertension, and heart disease? Almost everybody in the room is raising their hands. These are all genetic-related diseases, and that's why the topic is important. You probably don't realize it, but every single person sitting in this room has anywhere from 3 to 10 bad genes within themselves, deleterious, detrimental genes. We are not ill and don't have diseases because we do not have them in what we would call a homozygous state, where they can give expression within our body. So this is where the problem lies. Now with the progress of medical science in the Western world, and especially in the United States, we are taking care of more and more people with these defective genes and these genetic problems, and allowing them to live longer and longer. And the key thing is we are also allowing them to live to the stage where they can reproduce and give birth to children who in greater percentages will reflect these genetic diseases. The law of nature is survival of the fittest, and the defective usually die. And we have changed that in the human population with our medical science, and it is going to pose problems for us. Geneticists who have studied this issue feel that in the very few generations, some of them predicting as little as 5 generations down the line, every 10th child that is born in this country will have a major congenital defect of one nature or another. A heart defect, cleft palate, mental retardation, eye problems, all of these things are what lies ahead. All geneticists who study the field agree that we are headed in that direction. There is a lot of controversy of how far off it lies. As I say, some of them say as little as 5 generations from now, every 10th infant will be born with major defects. One geneticist has described the problem as saying, with our present technology, we are enabling the weak and deformed to live and to propagate their kind, and we are facing the prospect of a genetic twilight in our culture. But if we let them die and suffer, when we can relieve their suffering, maybe we're facing the prospect then of a moral twilight as well. You're probably not aware of it, but at least 25% of all conceived fetuses die within the first 2 months and are aborted. Most women, perhaps women are aware of that, but men are not. many times fertilization takes place, and a woman may be overdue on her menstrual period a week or 2 weeks, and then she'll have what she thinks is a normal menstrual period, but really, in fact, is a miscarriage, which has taken place. And most of the time, this is because the genetic material was so defective that life was not sustainable. So this is a natural process, and so there is a potential for a lot more genetic problems out there if we ever deal with that problem and sustain that life. If we make no attempt to modify the condition of the present genetic pool, and if medical science continues to treat individuals without regard to the wider genetic pool implications, the future generations are going to have higher and higher expression of these genetic defects. Let's talk about some of the specific things, the specific diseases and genetic problems that we're concerned with nowadays, and there are others on the horizon. Tay-Sachs disease, which is a disease mainly found in Jewish people of Eastern European origin. These children are born with a disease of the brain, which gradually it degenerates, and they usually die within infancy. We can, with our new technology, examine the amniotic fluid of the mother of people who are at risk for this, and with our squash technique and electron microscope, determine that they do, that the fetus does have the genes and will give expression to this particular disease. Then we can present the option to the parents of having a therapeutic abortion at that particular point, which most of them do.
How is it spelled?
Tay-Sachs disease, TAY/SACKS, Tay-Sachs disease. It's a very rare thing in the West, very prevalent along the East Coast, where a lot of these people have come to live in the United States. Cystic fibrosis is another disease, which is we see all over the U.S. and which you perhaps have had even some experience with. Cystic fibrosis people are, they have an abnormality of secretions within the body. They have the secretions within their lungs are unusually thick and viscous, and they're unable to clear them from their lungs, and they usually develop life-threatening infections within the lungs, and this is usually the cause of death. They also have abnormal GI tract, abnormal secretions for enzymes in their stomach and intestines, and this can usually lead to their death. In my early years of medicine, these people were living to become 11, 12, 13 years of age. Now, with our advances in antibiotics and other treatments, they're living into the mid-20s, and we're facing the problem that they are reproducing now at that age. Diabetes. Most of you have heard of diabetes, certainly, and with the advent of insulin, diabetics are living longer and longer. But prior to the advent of insulin, diabetics usually died relatively early in life and did not reproduce. Diabetes is the one disease which I think is most significant, which is increasing in frequency tremendously within our society. Hemophilia, the bleeding disease, is also increasing. And we're sustaining life longer and longer for these people. Sickle cell anemia, very important to the Negro population of our country, and a big problem in areas where they inhabit this country. These people are born with an abnormality of their red cells such that various types of environmental factors and various types of stimuli can cause their red cells, instead of to be a uniform round in color, to become like a quarter moon shape, a so-called sickle cell. And this leads to clogging up of the blood within various organs, and they die of heart attacks, or they end up with losing circulation to arms or legs or brain or other, any other appendage or organ of the body, which of course can be life-threatening or can just be very disabling. And it's a disease which progresses on and usually ends in an early death of the individual. Again, this is genetic disease. We can detect it, and we can inform parents that they're carriers for the disease. We can detect it when the child does have the disease, and we can modify his lifestyle and such to allow him to live longer and to reproduce himself. PKU, or phenylketonuria, is an enzyme disease. We, by law now, must check all infants at 10 days of life and at 30 days of life for this particular disease. It's a disease which is basically an allergic disease that they can't take glutine, one of the proteins, and therefore if they get on a glutine-free diet, they don't get the full expression of the disease. If they don't get the diet, then they usually become mentally retarded and die in infancy or at early age in life. Down syndrome, or mongolism. This is a problem with chromosomes not dividing properly during the reproductive process. And we can pick this up by the amniocentesis technique, which I talked about earlier. Can talk with the parents about therapeutic abortion. Many times, however, these children are born, they end up being institutionalized, and then we're faced with the problems of how do we deal with the multiple congenital abnormalities they may have along with their mental retardation. Should we prolong their life by taking care of their heart defect that they have, or should we take care of their blind esophagus that they may be born with, or when their trachea and esophagus is hooked together by a fistula, something that would cause them to die early, should we repair that so that they will live a fairly complete and full life? There are many other mental retardation type diseases, too numerous to list, that kids who are born with microcephalic heads, with very very small brains, there's no possibility of ever developing full mental abilities. Then we come to cancers. Cancer is a multiple faceted disease, if you want to talk about the cancer in general, but we do know that specific cancers are caused by genetic things. I have one family in my practice who each of the female members for four generations has developed cancer of the ovary in their mid-30s. And this is just totally inherited disease as far as they're concerned. Arthritis, the crippling rheumatoid arthritis is definitely a hereditary disease. We can do more and more to keep people from developing the gross deformities and the disabilities that we've seen in the past with people. But still, most of them end up fairly disabled at some point in their life. We may just delay its expression for many years. Hypertension, again, a genetic disease, especially in the Negro population of this country. And this can lead to problems also with kidney disease as one of the expressions of the hypertension. Now, there are a lot of proposals for dealing with genetic expression. One country, Denmark, that I'm aware of, has decided that the interests of society take precedent over the interests of the individual. And in that country, people with certain diseases are not allowed to marry unless they are sterilized prior to marriage. And this has been one way that the problem has been dealt with. But it's a multifaceted problem, and that in itself probably would not stop the growth of the disease, of these problems in our society. We all are aware of the fact that nowadays medical science can raise test tube babies and can, by use of artificial insemination, directly modify the genetic pool. This has been going on now for quite some time, and you know, you've recently been aware of all the publicity about the test tube baby, and this has definite moral implications, I think, for our society. One of the proposals presently being talked about in genetic circles is the use of mass artificial insemination. For a number of years with cattle breeding, we have been taking semen and freezing it for storage purposes. It can be kept for 20, 30 years and then unfrozen and used to artificially inseminate and produce the genetic influences that we want to do. It's been proposed that we take semen from the great men of our time and store it away for future use some years, 20 or 30 years after that person has given it, at a time when he's probably dead, so that we can see what the full expression of disease was throughout that individual's life, and then use that for artificial insemination purposes if it's good stock in years after that. Yeah?
Maybe you've heard the George Bernard Shaw quote, I'm sure it's familiar, but some beautiful model came up and said to George Bernard Shaw, "I wish you would father my child. Think of what brains he would have and what a beautiful body." And he said, "Madam, I decline. What if he had my body and your brain?"
So basically, that's the problem, and I thought maybe we'd talk a little bit about that now.
The question is, if there is such a male individual that is so free of disease that we can store, you know, the food to have our disease?
We are on the verge of being able to read the chromosomes of any individual in this country. The scary thing is we're also on the verge of being possibly able to modify those chromosomes in any way that we want to. One of the new breakthroughs that's going to come through in the next few years is the treatment of viral diseases. And one of the ways we're going to be able to treat these things is with medications which basically are RNA, or ribonucleic acid. And so we'll be able to modify the virus by genetic means with this RNA, and the potential is when we perfected it with RNA, then we can attack DNA, which is the material which your genes are made up with, and then begin the modification of these factors also.
So could you examine some chromosomes ahead of time, take a sample, and see if there are some defective ones? You said you're on the verge of being able to modify that, even take out the defective ones, and then say, first, but then you have to artificially inseminate. You have to, mm-hmm. You know, you could really get to be playing games.
That's right. I mean, you couldn't. We, at this particular point, can't modify every cell in the body. All that we're at the stage right now is that by doing the amniocentesis and looking at these cells, we can predict, you know, with some accuracy what lies ahead for that particular organism which is growing in there and you know, producing these cells.
I have a comment from the balcony. A year ago, we were going through a Lamaze class in preparation for childbirth, and one of the couples in the class had gone in. They went in and they recommended that she have these amniocentesis done, which they did, and they also did an ultrasound and found out that the baby she was carrying was what they call hydrocephalic. And she was 6 months pregnant, and at this point, you don't do an abortion, but they didn't, you know, for the rest of the class, it was really hard on us to see them going through the struggle, and they finally opted that she had a cesarean section and they allowed the baby to die. But it really brought it home to the rest of us, what if that you know, with us in that situation, what would we have done?
It's a real valid point, and it's one that I get involved in quite frequently.
Were we to say who that child would turn out to be like, though, you know, I know hydrocephalics, they have the shunts and all that done in there. They're not doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
And same when she said about Down syndrome, it kind of bothered me. I have a cousin that's that, and he's my age, and we've learned so much from him and gotten so much out of him.
Mm-hmm. The trend used to be that parents, when they gave birth to a Down syndrome child, they institutionalized the child. They turned the problem over to the state to use. But more and more people are making the choice to raise their own child.
That would be just like if you could read some chromosomes and say, well, in 20 years you're going to develop cancer, we better abort you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really. You're not going to be worth anything for very long, so they might get rid of you before you're born.
Why do you think that the older woman is more apt to have a Down syndrome child?
There's something magical about the age of around 35 years of age, that the chromosomes in dividing in the process of producing, for instance, the egg or the sperm, and it's associated with the woman in the production of the egg or the ovum, that the chromosomes do not completely separate into a 50-50. In other words, you end up with a 70% chromosome on one side and a 30% on the other side. And if the zygote is formed from the ovum, which contains that extra amount of chromatin there, then that extra amount of chromatin is allowed to give expression without having to be matched with a like chromosome from the male, and that's where you get your Downs problem. Yeah.
I used to hear that was at age 40. Is it lowered for some reason?
Well, it does happen with a certain frequency in the general population for all ages, but at the age of 35 and above, there's a big jump of about 50% at that particular age, and then it goes up as you get older.
But is it getting younger? You know, I used to think of 40, but
that's no.
About 35.
Yeah. But there are a certain number of couples in their 20s, for instance, who will produce a Down's child. That's part of their genetic pool that they happen to have these bad genes which give rise to this.
Well, now, would that young person that had that Down syndrome child apt to have another child that was normal, or would it be?
We can predict that they would be likely to have another child Downs, but not every one of them. You know,
uh-huh.
It would probably be one in four would be would be likely to have Downs.
What concerns me about the genetic issue and genetic manipulation is who can decide, like you were saying, what is normal. And I think we have to be very wary that it's not used politically. You know, I don't know if you've heard of Arthur Jensen, who has stated that he thinks blacks are genetically less intelligent than whites.
Mm-hmm.
And it's things like that I think we have to look at before we get too deeply what our intentions are.
Is it more threatening to have first baby at 35, as far as the syndrome is concerned, or if you had babies before?
I mean, are you more likely to have, say,
one is at 35 or beyond.
A Down's child?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, then, if you had your first child at 35 and had some subsequent babies after that, then risk
but I mean,
of having
you to baby 25 and then kept on having them till 40, is it as threatening if you had them before 35?
I can't really answer that, how that changes the expression. You know,
if you were a doctor today, the magic and the mystery and the wonder of prolonging lives of people that previously had died. But behind that blessing, there is an attending kind of curse that they cause some kind of proliferation of some poor genes. Now, and I think what the medical world is asking for is, what the heck do we do? You know, in some way, it's in that
thought of sometimes playing like God, when you've got a capability to do some things. And, you know, it can become very political, but we're not ready for that yet. I think there are still some very preliminary kind of questions and decisions that need to be made, and it's a tremendous kind of dilemma.
I was a...
More and more women are postponing having their first child now. Mm-hmm. Is there a danger in this?
Yes, there is.
Eventually we will have more Down syndrome babies.
Mm-hmm. If more and more women are waiting till later ages to have their children, then more and more of the children who are born will have Down syndrome.
So this is that much more important then?
Yes. Yes, we recommend for every woman over 35 that she have amniocentesis. You know.
How early in her pregnancy?
At about 6 to 9 weeks, probably, of pregnancy.
I once heard a lecture by Maud Sly of Chicago on cancer, and she was convinced that cancer was caused by two recessive genes joining, and it was a meeting of doctors, and she was so into trying to keep a record of cancer patients so that if two young people fell in love, they could go to a thing and see, do we have these recessive genes? And they all just laughed at her. They said, mm-hmm. We're not animals, we're human beings, we cannot do this.
Mm-hmm. But she was ahead of her time.
Yes, yeah, she was.
That's one of the things that we're dealing with these days.
Well, I was at a medical convention or seminar on this within the past month. This was by specialists. Did say that the bigger danger is the first babies past 35. If they have had some previously, the percentage is not as high as if it's the first past 35.
Okay. Is this true in cystic fibrosis also, your ratio 1:4 usually?
Well, each type of congenital abnormality has its own expression ratio, you know. Mm-hmm. They're not all 1:4, you know. There's a lot of difference.
How many of these genes do you think are recessive genes? And
the great majority of them. The babies that the 25% of conceived fetuses that die within the first 2 months are the ones who probably have the dominant genes,
mm-hmm.
the more severe expression of the genetic stuff, which doesn't allow them to develop.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mainly the recessive ones that we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about, if we're talking about ratios, then 1:4 is probably the most basic ratio, and that's the most, the highest expression of the disease that you're going to get. Is 1 out of 4 children to that particular couple
mm-hmm.
are likely to have the expression of the genes and have the disease, or the congenital abnormality.
I think we're mostly interested in the immediate situation in terms of certain kind of illnesses. I want to try to get back to the moral implications involved. And I think we can't discuss that, and we don't want to discuss that because it's almost too overwhelming to comprehend. It could be that maybe some of the science fiction novelists can help us as they project in imagination some of the consequences of genetic manipulation. One story I read was where the people carried like name tags, but it was sort of a chromosomic identification or something like that, and they had to mate according to certain combinations, you know, and it meant a fine stock of folks, but it certainly very narrowly limited your selection in terms of courting and mating, etc. Now that's kind of fascinating. Is that possible? We saw Adolf Hitler monkey around with the Aryan race, you know. He was going to do this kind of genetic control and only certain people, and that was a dictatorship kind of thing. In connection with controlling diseases and helping people to adapt for certain climates, that's another ramification of the scientific novelist. When the world runs out, you produce a kind of people that can live on Mars or something like that, and you achieve that genetically. Boy, that blows the mind, doesn't it, to think along those lines? And we're right at the beginning of a lot of those capabilities. We haven't really manipulated human genes to determine a kind of
not yet.
No.
But we sure can.
It could be right around the corner. How do you control that?
I had a question on things like x-ray and stuff like that. If it damages the fetus, does that become a genetic thing in that fetus to pass on? Or, I mean, like do outward things?
You can cause a mutation of genes by means of x-ray and these kinds of things. Most of the time, that's not genetically passed on, but it can be in some rare cases.
Has anyone ever followed up on Hitler's, these people that were supposedly super race individuals as to, did they turn out at all, or what? What happened in third and fourth generations after?
I think that they were not super people, basically, is what it boiled down to. They were common everyday people on the earth just like us. And
Germans are not common everyday
people. On a ratio of 50, they're 47.
Right.
What I heard you say there. What Hitler tried?
Well, it didn't carry through enough generations, but from our present understanding of genetics and what Hitler was trying to do with the little knowledge that he had, he was not really producing a super race. He was trying to purify, basically, a race, not to produce necessarily a super race.
He was getting a lot of bodies instead of brains.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of blondes, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was his were. Criteria. Was the
That's
blonder
right.
they were, the better they were.
Yeah. Are there any conclusions yet on that sterilization you mentioned?
On sterilization, what?
Was it the Denmark?
Oh, in Denmark.
Sweden?
Well, in Denmark, this is in fact the law of the land.
How long has it been that way?
It's only been a few years, you know.
Mm.
But do you think, I think Chuck's asked a valid question. Should the interests of society take precedence over the interests of the individual in, say, allowing two mentally retarded people to marry who are likely to produce some mentally retarded children, two people with, or people with these various diseases that are likely to pose problems? If you, I mentioned the economic things, all of these diseases that we've talked about, all of them are tremendous consumers of our medical dollars to allow them to live.
And social problems that are created.
I saw a young boy walking down the street the other day with a head the size of a watermelon. I mean, I never saw anything like it. Just a gigantic head. And, probably, 5, 6, 7 years ago, well, he was about 10. I don't know how he could have been alive yet. But it was probably some sort of medical miracle that kept him living.
That particular individual probably had 3, 4, 5 operations on his brain to produce a shunt to drain off the fluid from the head into the heart. You see, we do this all the time, but these shunts only last for 2, 3, 4 years, and then they clog up, and then they have to be brought back in and go through this whole process again. And we, in the hospitals that I practice in, I see these children all the time being brought back and the shunts revised and repaired and fixed and turned loose to go back out in society again, you see.
Who's going to be the one that's making all these decisions in the future? The government
that's,
always gets...
You're the one that's going to answer
see,
that,
doctors,
I hope, for us.
The doctors will work for life. And then we have the problem.
And the government works for money.
I don't know, I work with mentally retarded people, and people think God's done stupid, and they trick me in society, but you can learn so much from MR people. I mean, these are the people that don't have worries and stresses and problems that we have today. I think if there's, let two mentally retarded people get married. These are the ones who can bring peace. Maybe they don't have the brains, but they sure don't have the stresses either.
It depends on the level of retardation. If you go through a state hospital where there are rooms and rooms and rooms full of people in their early adult years, lying in cribs with IQs of 1, and they will never feed themselves, never verbalize, never walk.
Yeah, but those people, you can always learn something. I mean,
well, you might learn that the strong have to take care of the weak, but they're not functioning.
But they are not functioning, but you can, there's always many people who want to say a mother, and you know, these.
But they're an institution.
But, so then normal people can go up to those people.
That, you know, that raises another issue, like, do we need, if we could genetically accomplish something that, let's say, eliminated mental retardation, we certainly don't want to say, let them be mentally retarded because those of us who aren't need them. Oh, that's awful. You know, we need them to learn, or we need them to be examples of peace or something. It really doesn't make a whole lot of sense if we have the capability of eliminating that, right?
Except if it's your child who's born retarded.
No, I'm not saying eliminate the child.
Yeah.
I'm saying eliminate the condition.
Yeah.
You know, if we have somewhere that capability.
Well, in determining who's going to decide this genetically, I mean, it's easy to put it in another country, but it's been a very short few years that there was law in our country that everyone with epilepsy and everyone who went into a mental hospital had to be sterilized. And it's been a short time right in here in the United States. So we decided who determines why, because now melanoma is known to be something that can be temporary, of course. Epilepsy can be completely controlled in the majority of the cases. And who has the right to say that those people had to be sterilized? So I mean, it's the same thing with all diseases. I mean, just like those, really. I mean, you can't pick
Carol?
It from our country. It's been here.
I wondered if, I got here late, so I don't know if you've addressed this, but I wonder if one of the problems that I see is that the technological advancements on one side far outstrips the other. And I wonder if you could say something about, is there such a thing as genetic repair that affects the individual himself?
After the individual is in fact conceived, we can at this particular point genetically repair him.
Can?
We can't.
Yeah, no. We can. Is there any breakthrough at all that is towards that, is looking towards that? Not just repairing for future generations from that damaged individual, but himself or herself.
Well, not at this particular point there isn't, you see. Let's say a person has a cleft lip, you know. What is a cleft lip? It's an abnormality of billions of cells in the genetic development process. We can, through the use of plastic surgery and other things, we can repair that individual so that they are, you know, look just like anybody else, and they don't have to wear that deformity through the rest of their life. But they also are carrying the genes to pass that on to anybody that they may produce from that particular point on. And that's where we may be able to stop the process right there. Right. Yeah, you see with artificial insemination, the process where we can actually take the ovum from the woman and fertilize it with the sperm from her husband, there would be a possibility in there that we could do genetic manipulation at that particular point to remove the genes which would pass on that particular deformity. And then you could reimplant the ovum, the fertilized ovum, back in the woman, and she can continue on with a normal pregnancy.
Have we been able to identify those particular, I mean, can you see that genetic deformity in the gene?
Yes, we can. To many cases right now. Mary, you had
a question. Isn't it a law in this country that cousins cannot marry? Mm-hmm. So there has been legal action as far, I mean, when people say that certain people should not be allowed to marry, everybody gets all upset. But we have had that on the books.
From a,
in every state?
Two or three generations. Big deal with the, I think it was with the Roosevelt. I don't know how far removed they were. But from my point of view, what you were just talking about, and her behind me here, I would think that would be all right to remove them and remove those genes that were bad and put it back in there. It's still the same sperm, still the same egg and that whole bit. But to answer the little lady over by the window there, I would say, how far is she and millions of Americans willing to go to turn our whole business of living over to the government? What happens when the government takes over the medical profession? Then they make their own decisions in Washington. So that's up to you and every American in this country to keep the government from taking the whole cotton picking thing over, as they did in Denmark.
Well, that's kind of the, one of the reasons for having this thing, as far as I'm concerned, is to make you better informed about what is going on, because you, as individuals, will perhaps have something to say about future legislation that will affect this whole particular area.
Isn't there a board or something in HEW that sort of rules, decrees, at least in terms of experimentation and development along the whole line of genetic?
Yes, National Institutes of Sciences will, you know, makes all of the definitive rulings on this particular area.
All right, so there are certain kind of parameters within which medical people, scientists, have to function. What do you have to do? Get permission or something?
That's
do
right,
a certain
yeah.
kind of experiment?
They would fund all of this type of research, and therefore they direct it. But also, like, there's some real problems now in, when we're talking about RNA and DNA research, because we're so afraid that we're going to produce forms of life which we cannot deal with, which would lead to diseases, that we presently don't have the technology to deal with, and so they're very, very limiting that particular area at this time.
And the clout is the money, is that it?
That's right, clout is money.
But that's just exactly what you said. If they fund it, they direct it.
That's right.
They run the whole show.
But
once you start taking their money, you might as well turn over the reins, though. That's it, in anything. I don't care what it is.
But there's another point to that. You can't have some Frankenstein someplace, you know, putting together some sort of monster. One, because you can't afford it. And number two, it's become sort of illegal in terms of, you know, there's that possibility.
The Frankenstein is more easily controlled than bureaucrat.
Well, the alternative...
You have only one compared to millions.
That's right. The alternative
the
is
American,
no control.
Or the College of American... doctors and physicians or something, why couldn't they control their own, but of course the money problem.
No, I don't think you want to turn it over to the doctors necessarily either, do you?
No. Mm-hmm. At least they're intelligent enough to see the fallacy of it, or to see
You know, doctors get carried away with their technology. That's one of the problems that we have nowadays, you know. Doctors can think nothing about, but gee, I'm, you know, this marvelous thing I'm doing, and there's, you know, they don't care who they're doing it to and what the future implications are of what they're doing.
Have you read the book Coma?
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Oh, Brave New World.
Yeah, that's Brave New World has a lot to say to this area. We're talking about cloning, you know, this. If you want to talk about the sperm banks and the use of sperm of great men, that's not very far removed from cloning.
This raises another question about this genetic subject, about the education of new doctors going on. And I know you brought up the other day that there's not much experimentation going on, and perhaps in the hospitals, perhaps there's not the dramatic experimentation there was years ago in terms of surgery, but there is a lot of learning being done on people that are patients. And I'm wondering, what kind of, you know, what's going to happen when we start eliminating all these diseases, which there are some that I really feel that we should work on. But I'm wondering if just our whole environment will not continue to create new diseases, and we will only learn of these diseases when the people are here. you know, we might not do it before they're born. So while this sounds really bad to learn from somebody's illness, like diabetes, people, you know, who experimented on it, and it became such a miracle drug.
We're going to talk about next week about experimentation, and especially human experimentation, and face that problem, I think, then, hopefully. Mitch?
This all relates too back to so many other things, like the costs that we talked about the first part of the week. If we do eliminate some of the costly, what we consider now to be costly diseases like cancer that are taking people earlier in life, then they're going to live longer. They have some of the more horrendously costly diseases, like the strokes and so on, that we'll be paying another kind of price for that.
I think you also have to look at the resources and whatnot in the future, too. As we get more people, when you have more people with genetic defects, how that is going to affect that. You start running low on resources and economics. Also, who's going to decide whether those people are going to be able to use up those resources or not?
I would remind you that all of the almost all of the chemicals that we're using are derived from petrochemical today. So maybe there's a limited source there.
Where else, aside from the United States, is genetic research being done? And is it community effort, or
it's in all of the Western worlds, you know, the Western high technology countries is where it's all basically going on.
What about like Russia?
Russia is probably doing a lot of it. When we're talking, the only places that you're not doing with things like this are places like India, where Dr. Sewell was from. I mean, they've got such just tremendous problems with too many people. They're trying to get rid of them, not trying to keep them alive. You know, in those countries.
At the Ohio District Convention of the American Lutheran Church a couple of weeks ago, a resolution was presented from a group of people that had been studying genetics and genetic manipulation in a Sunday school class. And they made this resolution that the Ohio District memorialize the American Lutheran Church to study the feasibility of establishing at the national level a board of the United States government that would be made up of theologians and physicians and everybody, psychologists, you know, to rule on a lot of these questions about genetic use and genetic experimentation and that kind of business. And the reaction of the body was, first of all, wow, you want to play God, now you want to establish a committee of gods. You know, there's right away a negative kind of reaction to somebody controlling. You know, there are always fears in both directions with control. So the thing finally went through and passed because I think people realized, well, we really ought to have somebody thinking about it. You know, we ought to try. And I don't know what the ALC is going to do with it. They get the problem now of studying the feasibility of whether or not such a board makes any sense. That's a legitimate question. You know, let's explore that and examine that and weigh all the possibilities. Instead of just dismissing it right away.
What's the climate in the medical profession in terms of addressing the question, the ethical issues involved with, say, genetics? Is there openness to receive this kind of questioning and discussion and so on?
Oh, yes. Yeah. The medical profession, I feel that the medical profession recognizes the implications and tries to define the problem for society, and then looks upon society to tell them which direction they want them to go. In a way, I think that's the way you could say the medical.
For instance, something like what he just talked about—a resolution at a district convention—how would that be received?
I think it would be welcome. I think the medical profession and people who recognize the problem are becoming more and more concerned about it because they feel that the government and the people in general are not aware of the problem and are not even beginning to think about how we need to deal with it. This is the other thing that's alarming to me right now is we know that, I hope there are not any lawyers in here, but I think legally, the legal profession and the courts are coming in and complicating everything. And this is one of the areas. We take the issue of, I have a mother who has a daughter who's mentally retarded, who's very promiscuous in her retardation, and would like to have her sterilized. With the present legal community and things that are going on, the mother is not allowed to make the decision whether that daughter should be sterilized or not. It must be turned over to the courts. The courts must appoint a lawyer to represent the best interest of the daughter, and then, of course, the mother has to get her own lawyer, and then we bring this matter before the courts. And we all know how the slowness of our legal system, which may take a number of years, and the advocate, which is appointed for the retarded daughter, almost always will resist tying the tubes. To me, it's paradoxical. We complicated it so much with the legal entry into the whole area. Mary?
This is not a subject, and maybe it isn't apropos, but it's something that bothers me about any time we discuss large sums of money for genetic research to eliminate Down syndrome or cystic fibrosis, which really affects a very, very small portion of the world's population. I read a United Nations report, and we have my facts straight, but it was something like the Western world spends $5 billion on cancer research, which is a middle-class, first-world disease, and we have a fourth of the world dying of
malnutrition.
What is it? Something in Africa that they get from parasites or mosquitoes or something. And 2 million is spent on something like that. Whereas if that disease was along the Colorado River and Americans were dying of it, we'd have it licked. But because it doesn't affect our people, I think so much of the moral stance of the United States just goes down the drain when we aren't looking at our global brothers and sisters and just concentrating on what affects us. You know, our hypertension and cancer, which besides being genetically induced, I think also have a lot to do with our environment, the stress,
right,
the kind of lifestyle that we live. So I get disturbed when I even think about the amounts of money we spend on diseases.
And on the whole, we may be the least deserving of it because we are making the greatest demands in the world on resources, etc., material abundance, and so on, and putting the least back into the world.
For the people that are going into medical profession now, getting a lot of background on this type of thing in the schools, or?
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with that. We had a consortium of doctors, medical students, and people from the seminary, and lawyers in Columbus, Ohio Seminary, and from what I understood there, the medical students were required to take only one course in ethics over their 4 years. That was just a basic. And they didn't really address in detail the type of issues that we were talking about today. They were offered collective units on those things. I can just speak for Ohio State there.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't. And in the consortium, I wasn't in it, but Dr. Bowman, who was here, was in it, and some of my friends looked upon advice given from at least from seminarians and professors as virtually having no weight at all. They would like to see us as professional handholders, and a lot of the moral issues that we tried to bring into the discussion were quickly written off.
I would have to modify my response in response to his and say that the medical profession and medical education, like all education, is changing tremendously. They didn't have any courses in, as I said the other day, in sexuality or in moral issues at all when I went through medical school. Almost every medical school in the United States now has sexuality courses. Almost all of them now are getting into the medical ethics area, and these courses are becoming more and more. You've got to realize that we've got a tremendous increase in medical information, and we're adding years and years and years on to our education process to turn out that doctor with all of these, this explosion of information and technology and adding these other issues to it. And so there are time constraints, but I think the medical profession is concerned about all of these issues, really, when you come down to it.
I think that medical students aren't too disturbed about the moral issues. I was involved with an ongoing seminar at Case Western Reserve Medical School in Cleveland. They could really care less, you know. It seemed like they had more important things to do and to study.
They do.
And in a sense, that's probably true.
They do. They got to make the next grade.
Get it off.
Well, and I hope they know what they're cutting when they start cutting, especially on me. But it's a little later on, I think, when they begin to realize, what they're really playing with, that they start wondering, holy smoke, you know, I can't answer these questions myself. And they start looking around then in the society.
Hasn't that lent itself to specialization then, where people have gotten into, say, even the heart and mm-hmm. specializing in just vital organs?
Sure, the medical explosion has led to increasing specialization.
And so the general practitioner he's capable of finding out the first symptoms, but then he's referring.
See, the general practitioner has been replaced by the family physician nowadays, and family physician is capable of treating 85 to 95% of all disease in most individuals. And then he has the knowledge to recognize where his limitations arise and to refer then on up to the secondary or tertiary level of care, which we had talked about on Monday in terms of developing
an interesting pyramid. Thing in what college people are thinking, in a survey of 198,000 college students, a ranking of what you think is important in life. There were 18 choices. And number four was, either four or five, depending on whether it's public or private, was developing a life philosophy. All right, so that's somewhere down. That's moral, ethical, you know, life stance. 18th last choice, as significant, is making a significant scientific contribution to society. You know, apparently current students in college these days and universities don't think a whole lot of science and are, at least at this point, a little more concerned about some philosophical, moral issues. Maybe that'll have some ramifications in the doctors of the future. I don't know.
I think that has more to say of their own faith in themselves to do it rather than what they really think is really low. I mean, I don't know any of these kids you're talking about, but I would say, I would bet that they just didn't have that much faith in themselves that they'd be another Einstein.
Well, what it was saying is, what do you want to do? What do you think is important to do? And they didn't think that was very important at all.
The man didn't feel that they could do it. And to them, then it wouldn't be important.
Maybe it was...
If I can't do something, it's maybe not that important to me.
Where maybe it was growing up in a world where scientific discovery was a high priority and seeing what the repercussions of that could be and wanting to put some direction on it and also incorporating it into their lifestyle as well, more than their confidence that they could do it.
And also that the issues are not that clear cut anymore. The change in the whole concept of physics. There's a Pritchard Capra at Berkeley who has written a book called The Tao of Physics, And he points out there that under Newtonian physics, which most of us learn physics under, there were clear-cut physical laws. And it was all very objective, and you could go on. But with Einstein and the discovery of the theory of relativity and the whole business of the atom, that suddenly we have this business of injecting the observer into physical phenomena. For instance, if you look at what an atom is, what happens in an atom through the electron microscope, some people see it as a wave. And others see the essential part of an atom as a particle. So you have a whole, is it a wave or is it a particle? What is the difference? The difference is that when I observe it, I may see a wave. When you observe it, you may see a particle. And the observer is injected into the whole objective phenomena. So suddenly you're not sure anymore. You know, there's nothing out there that's absolute anymore in the whole physical world, and that's changing our whole understanding of everything. So suddenly medical students aren't so sure anymore about what's gonna happen. And none of us are sure. And there is one assumption that you made, John, at the beginning that I want to ask you about, whether there's data to substantiate it. Is it true that since the life of individuals with genetic diseases has been prolonged, that there has been a corresponding increase in the ratio of people with genetic diseases to the normal population?
Mm-hmm. That's what the biggest problem is.
That actually has been substantiated, even allowing for the fact that we had poor data before, say, statistics were kept.
Sure, because the individual who already is expressing the genetic material is going to pass on that genetic material to each of his progeny. If I'm an individual who has, say, one bad chromosome, only half of my progeny are likely to get that chromosome, not every one of them. And so the person who is giving expression to that particular thing is going to give it to every one of his progeny, 100% increase. Rudy?
Now, I think from the point of view of the public, too, there's been perhaps too much reliance on science to solve the problem. And now the scientist has come to the point that we're not sure of the answer any longer. It isn't a simple thing, as has just been pointed out. And the public has to become educated to the point that it becomes involved. And I think it's, as you pointed out earlier, this is something that cannot be left entirely to the elite. The doctors and the scientists are not in a position to really solve some of these really basic major questions that are before us in society at this time and place. And I think that's the big issue that the church really must face in terms of education and in terms of getting involved in this whole problem of ethics and what should be done, is more a theological question than it is a scientific question.
That's why I was very happy to have Chuck inform us about that other thing, which I had no knowledge at all about. So our church, it does look like it's beginning to stir and beginning to look at this particular issue.
Reluctantly.
Mm-hmm. Sure, but that's the way we always do. We start that way.
I know doctors and pastors in like Minneapolis and the areas around there that they'll have conferences with their, you know, like the pastor of that person that's in the hospital will meet with the doctor. And, you know, I guess most of the doctors I know in that area are very receptive to meeting with the pastors and treating the whole person.
May I say, in Rochester at Mayo, they have a genetic counseling program where people who do have problems are off for nothing. They don't pay a thing. They go there. They want the information. They want to follow through, of course. But it's offered for nothing. But the problem is the people have to make the decisions. And like anything else, I'd rather have somebody else do it for me. And they...
But maybe society, maybe we're asking the question also, maybe society, since they have an interest in it too, should also have some place to play in that decision.
At least the counseling can offer the information and give them the facts. It isn't that we're leaving these people out cold.
In terms of clergy, I can't speak for all, but I think there's an immediate reaction among a large number of clergy folk that you shouldn't play God, you know, and dispense with the whole cut and picking operation. it seems like there's a limited number of clergy minds or mindsets that see somehow this whole capability within medicine and science as a gift of God. I think the large proportion of them think of it as a gift of the devil, and are willing to wrestle and roll around with that. So, you know, it's not a thing that clergymen set easily with, just as doctors don't.
I think in our area, I'd say the opposite.
Is that right?
Except lack of information, lack of opportunity, lack of input. But I feel that there's a growing edge of excitement about helping people think through moral issues. At least from my viewpoint, right?
Mm-hmm. But if you go along with the theory to the last analysis of we shouldn't play God, then we should let everybody die who gets sick.
Right.
Or we shouldn't replace the part. Or we shouldn't, you know, because should we're have. Playing God. If God mm-hmm. wants that person to die, yeah. let them die.
I kind of have a personal interest in this too, because I'm a diabetic, and a lot of this genetic recombinant research will directly benefit me. Right now, well, this is kind of, I think the experiment that kind of made the scientists back off and say, well, let's take a second look at what we're actually doing, is that they've been able to take a normal intestinal bacteria, E. coli, and recombine the genes of it so that it will produce insulin and implant this bug in a diabetic, and that bug will work as their pancreas and make insulin for them. And the research was cut off, the money was cut off, because they said, wow, look, what if we'd end up with a bacteria that would do something else to that person, you know, or what are the repercussions of that? For myself, I'd rather have that bug implanted than have
the
shallow
be good. So the bug can be the
new Frankenstein. Will it make more than just insulin?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
You may grow a trunk.
Stop with that. Out of your
yeah. Everything has a rip.
Yeah.
That's something, you know, you have to decide where the risk is and what, you know, risks you will.
She should come back on the day you talk about experimentation, because there may be a possibility that she would be willing to be one of those experiments.
And God's home today.
Most things are experimental. You don't know the effects of, like, birth control effects, the pills, the first when they come out, you know, they didn't realize the risk involved. A lot of the oral diabetic medication, now they're saying causes cancer. They've taken those off the market. You know, you don't know the risks until
later on.
No matter how much they've tested.
Our time is up. I'll be glad to stay.
There's another question there.
Well, you talk about cancer being a genetic disease, and yet they talk about all these chemicals and things that cause cancer now.
No, I'm not saying that cancer is caused only by genetics. Cancer is a multifaceted disease. We know that definitely some cancers are caused just by viruses. Some of them are caused just by chemicals in the environment that people are exposed to, the cigarette, for instance. But some are definitely genetic related also. There have been
some are psychosocial.
Yeah.
And wouldn't be some of them you have the thing and never have it activated. Is that possible?
Yes. Yeah. You can. Some people. You know. There is some theories that we all carry the genes for a potential type of a cancer, say, and if we abuse our body in such a way, or if we come in contact with the right stimulants somehow, then that gene will give expression and will start then to manifest the cancer. This may be, you know, one of the 3 to 10 deleterious genes that each one of you is carrying in your body at this particular time. So we'll end on that note.